Yeah, I don't know what it is, RJ. You know, we kind of, people say we're looking for trouble all the time, but I don't know. That's why we like playing that Dropkick Murphy song, folks. For those of you who don't understand why we play The Boys Are Back, because we have a very controversial show. We talk about a lot of stuff that mainstream media doesn't talk about here on City Spotlight Special Edition. Dave Krieger and RJ Malloy with you for another exciting episode. And, of course, as usual, we rip into the latest dirt and disinformation that may be out there and try to make sense of it all. The Epoch Times
Wait a minute. We're supposed to make sense of this?
Well, I thought that's what we were doing. You're the legal voice of reason here.
Yeah, well, let's move on.
Yeah, all right, here we go. 4,000, almost 4,000 fully vaccinated people in Massachusetts test positive for COVID-19. Now, I go back to the saying, if you go get a flu shot, what do they give you a little dose of?
Flu.
All right. So you go get a COVID shot, what do they give you a dose of? Don't answer that.
Yeah, right.
Come on, folks. I mean, really? I'm not going to even say, are you stupid? No, we're not even going to go there, because we figure that if folks don't understand that they're getting injected with the actual COVID the virus itself, I don't know what to tell them.
But they're only – it's modifying their cells. This is what we know from Dr. Mikovic now, so I'm just being a parrot. But it modifies the cells to produce the spike protein. And then your body says, ooh, this doesn't belong here, and it goes and attacks it. And then it remembers that you had this spike protein. All right, that was the good news. The bad news is the guy – and this came out yesterday in an article – the guy that invented – the mRNA process.
Dr. Robert Malone.
That's right. He said, ooh, we just figured out that the lipids don't stay at the injection site. They're finding their way into the heart and the forebrain. So there's some good news for everybody that's been vaccinated.
No doubt. Yeah, well, the University of Florida, a laboratory there at the University of Florida, has recently analyzed a small sample of face masks and detected the presence of 11 dangerous pathogens that included bacteria that caused diphtheria, pneumonia, and meningitis. And now these were from Gainesville, and they were from school children and one adult that was wearing these things regularly all day long. And they sent them in for evaluation, and voila, we have all these different bacteria inside of these particular masks that were sent in. Five of them were found to be contaminated with parasites, fungi, and bacteria. According to Rational Ground, only one mask was found to contain a virus that can cause a fatal systemic disease in cattle and deer.
Oh, great.
Lord only knows where that guy was. The other less harmful pathogens that can cause ulcers, acne, and strep throat were also detected. So you gotta love why people are wearing masks. We don't understand that.
So I shouldn't be proud of the fact that during all of 2020, All during the shutdown, I wore the same mask every day.
Yeah,
I should not be proud of that.
That might be problematic. And not only that, but if you plan on going to college in Tennessee, one of the colleges there plans to charge students who have not gotten the vaccine over $1,000 extra per semester, pending the full approval of the vaccines, Rhodes College said in a recent letter to students. It expects the FDA approval of the shots before encouraging, that's the word, encouraging, students to get the jab. In anticipation of the approval, they strongly recommend all students be vaccinated this summer, but now they're coming up with this $1,500 per semester health and safety fee to cover the cost of mandatory testing.
You make money wherever you can.
God, you got to love that. And so, you know, why do I bring this up, folks? Well, Joe Mercola turned me on to this guy. And this guy has been teaching propaganda at New York University in the Steinhardt School of Culture, Education, and Human Development for over two decades. And his name is Mark Crispin Miller. And he he had class one day, and apparently, I'm going to let him tell the story. Mark Miller, welcome to City Spotlight.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me on, guys. I really appreciate it. You want me to tell my story?
I really would love to hear this. I read it, and I'm like, oh, this can't be true.
So, that's welcome to my world. Let me say that, you know, you say I've been teaching propaganda for two decades. I mean, I don't teach people how to do propaganda. I teach the study of propaganda, right? I think my own view is that there should be courses on propaganda and how to perceive it and how to analyze it in every high school and college in the country. I can think of few things more important than that, and that's been my kind of guiding philosophy teaching the course at NYU. So what happened last fall was unprecedented for me. I had, you know, we had to meet by Zoom, right, because of COVID. And I explained, as I always do, that I don't teach propaganda as an academic subject. I don't treat it as some remote historical phenomenon, you know, like what the Nazis did and what the Bolsheviks did. We certainly study all that as background, but the main purpose of the course is to teach students how to perceive propaganda in real time. You know, in other words, I prefer to deal either with very recent propaganda drives or with propaganda drives ongoing right at that moment. And that's challenging. That's tough. I tell the students, you know, it's very easy for all of us to notice propaganda that we don't agree with. It's very easy. So you ask a liberal for an example of propaganda, the liberal will say Fox News. And if you ask a conservative for an example of propaganda, he or she will say MSNBC. And they're both right, right? But also they're half blind because they can't see it when they agree with it. And that's the challenge. It's a challenge for everybody. It's been a challenge for me. So I make clear that if you're going to study propaganda really impartially, you're going to have to be prepared to move out of your comfort zone, right? So I said, what might we study in this course? What's going on at the moment we could study, and you know, what's something you might want to write your papers on? I said, well, look at how we're meeting, you know, by Zoom. You hate this. I hate this. Why is this happening? Well, obviously, it's happening because of the COVID crisis. I said, now this crisis has been driven by a number of propaganda themes that we all know, and that is not to say that they're false. You know, propaganda can be benign. It can be accurate. It's only an organized attempt to get large numbers of people to think or do something. So a campaign to, you know, have people wear their seatbelts when they drive, that's propaganda too. So, you know, to say that the COVID crisis has been driven by propaganda themes doesn't necessarily mean they're false or malevolent, right? But, you know, propaganda, even when it's accurate, tends to be very one-sided. It tends to be very simple. That's how it works. So I said, for example, we could study the mask mandates, all right? I had no idea what was going to happen when I made that suggestion. I said, I encourage you to read all the scientific literature on masking, all of it. You may be interested to know that all the randomized controlled trials, that's the most rigorous kind of scientific study, all of those studies that have been conducted so far over the last, say, 20 years, have all found that masks do not prevent the transmission of respiratory viruses. I encourage you to read those studies. And you know that, you know, a number of recent studies have come out claiming that masks do work. I would urge you to, you know, read those too. Okay. I gave them some tips on how a non-scientist can judge such things. And that was that. And the following week, a student asked to join the class late. And I said, sure, as I always do. The second day she was there, the subject of masks came up again. She hadn't been there for the full discussion. And she was so infuriated by what she took to be my claim that masks don't work, my claim. And she didn't say a word in the class. She went on Twitter a few days later and demanded that I be fired for this, right? Now, that was unpleasant, but not that big a deal in itself. She has the First Amendment right to do that. I wish she'd brought it up in class. But what happened next is not acceptable, and that is basically that NYU took her side very publicly. My department chair tweeted his thanks. He said, we as a department have made this a priority and are discussing next steps. This completely blew my mind. They did other things like that. Cut to the chase. The following month, a majority of my department colleagues demanded that my conduct be reviewed by the dean, claiming that according to the rules at NYU, if a professor's behavior is sufficiently hideous, that person forfeits his or her academic freedom. And they claimed that that was the case with me. They accused me of discouraging my students from wearing masks, of hate speech, of maintaining an unsafe learning environment, of attacks on students and others in our community, of microaggressions and aggressions. This is mind-boggling. I have never done any of those things. The dean went right ahead and ordered the review without talking to me. And I sent my colleagues a detailed rebuttal, point by point, and asked them to retract their letter and apologize, and they ignored that. I asked them again, and they ignored that too. So I am suing them for libel, okay? I'm suing 19 of my department colleagues for libel because this kind of censorship, this kind of bullying, you know, this kind of slander, it's not just happening to me, as I'm sure you know. It's been happening with alarming frequency over the last year or so with many professors and journalists and doctors and scientists being censored, being blacked out, being gagged, being vilified. So I see my lawsuit as an effort to kind of turn the tide, you know? And that's, you know, if anyone is interested, there's a petition up at change.org. If they do a search on change.org in my name and academic freedom, they can find it. And I have a GoFundMe page. You know, if you do a search on my name and libel and GoFundMe, you'll find that I, you know, am raising as much money as I can for this. I expect it to be a protracted lawsuit. And I'm delighted that I've raised over $100,000 because I really think that I'm up against NYU as a corporation. I don't think my colleagues' attack just happened by accident. So that's my story.
And you're sticking to it.
I am. I am sticking to it.
Yeah.
This is just outrageous. And all the documents, guys, all the documents in my case are up on my website, which is markcrispinmiller.com.
RJ, you're the legal voice of reason here. What say you?
I think that Mark has got really solid legal grounds because of the way that he presented the information to the class. He gave them both sides. He said, here's some stuff that says it works, and here's some stuff that says it doesn't work, and go and draw your own conclusion. And that's what I got from the narrative that I just heard. And if that ends up in the pleading, that's a pretty solid pleading. And then he's got to show damages. Well, his reputation has been smeared. He almost lost his job. You know, there's a lot of other things that are hurting, especially somebody that's a professor. Like if you and I, somebody said stuff like that about us, we'd just shrug, right?
But yeah, we just go out and have a Guinness.
That's
know,
right.
Just,
in Mark's profession, though, his reputation is what creates his path to tenure and his longevity in an institution. And they put that in jeopardy.
Well, they labeled him a conspiracy theorist.
Well, you can label anybody anything you want, but does it actually do harm to that person? And I think in Mark's position, there is some harm being done to him. And then he's gone through this process that he just described that should have been fair and open. And so he has this right, you know, to a fair and open tribunal to determine whether there's a problem or not. And if that was done properly, I think that a reasonable, rational person, which would be a juror in this case, would say, you know, he did the right stuff. He gave them both sides of the equation. He didn't tell them, don't wear a mask.
In fact, I very pointedly said to them that first day, I am not telling you not to wear masks, right? This is an intellectual exercise. Now, I want to be perfectly honest about this. You know, when I present evidence to support a counter-narrative, I'm not coy about it. You know, I let the class know what my view is, but I make very clear that that's my view, and they are free. In fact, they are welcome to argue with me, right? I say to them at the beginning, you know, throughout this semester, I'm going to be mentioning evidence of counter-narratives that may strike you as outrageous, and you may even get angry, right? I've had this happen many times. I say, look, if that happens, just go and look into it yourself. Look into it, okay? If you find that I'm wrong, I want you to tell me in class, and we can argue about it. Maybe I'll change my mind. If you find that I'm right, you've learned something. Because, you know, when you study propaganda, you often find that something you have long believed and fervently believed turns out to be false. I mean, I continue to have this experience. I'm over 70, you know. I think if your mind is still alive, you're going to reconsider your assumptions. And when you study propaganda, as opposed to kind of letting it wash over and into you without really focusing on it, which is the way most of us take it in, when you study it, you come to some really, you know, startling revelations. You know, you really have to change the way you regard the world. You know, you might have to rearrange the furniture in your mind. You know, and I have to say, my students are overwhelmingly delighted and grateful, you know, by this experience. I told the dean when he informed me he was going to conduct this review of my conduct, which I don't think has ever taken place. I can explain that. I told him I'm going to have students write on my behalf, you know, to you. And he said, okay. And they got over 50 letters, you know, and those are up on my website too. So, you know, my conscience is completely clear, and I will not sit still for an attack on my teaching, you know, which I'm extremely proud of. It's completely outrageous. But I have to say that although my colleagues are all social justice warriors, you know, they're very woke, and they've accused me of hate speech and other things like that, I think that behind them is the corporate hand of NYU, which is very heavily invested in the vaccine industrial complex, you know, very heavily invested in the whole COVID narrative. And I don't think they want someone like me, you know, going online and, you know, sharing forbidden information, which I think is the whole function of higher education. It's to get people to think, it's to challenge them. And that's being treated as a kind of crime at this university.
I have two considerations here. One would be this person who came in late, and you know, was that a plant? Was that was somebody coming in to get the goods on you because they heard about what you were doing and that it was against this corporate narrative? That would be one of my first points of wanting to know what's going on. The second is, you know, Dave and I have had to do this, certainly not on your level of intensity, but Dave and I disagree on a lot of things, and we keep telling our listeners, don't believe a word that we say. Go look it up. Go research it. We're just bringing it to your attention.
Yeah,
you know, don't write in and complain about what Dave said or what I said. Go look it up. You know, figure it out for yourself.
Yeah, that's exactly what I say. This is uncanny. I say the first day and throughout the semester, when I present evidence of a counter-narrative that angers you, remember, my most important rule here is you should not believe a single word I say. I say that too.
Yes.
I say I'm not an oracle. You know, I don't know everything. I've studied a lot of things in depth. You know, I could be wrong. So don't go off and tell, you know, your roommates or your family, my professor says X. That would be my propagandizing you. Now, as for the student being a plant, you're hardly the first person to suspect that. People have been saying this to me for months. But, you know, look, the defendants filed a motion to dismiss, right, like in January. And we responded to that And they replied, so we've been waiting for months for the judge to decide on their motion. Their claim is that they did not lie about me, that everything they said is true. And as evidence for this, their exhibits are mostly comprised of their own prior email exchanges about me, okay? I mean, it's kind of remarkable. They really reveal more than they should, it seems to me. But one of the exhibits is a description of a meeting with this student after the first class she took with me. She was already complaining. Then it was the second class that had her move to Twitter. What I'm saying is the evidence tells me that she is not a plant, but that she's someone whose disquiet and irritation I think my colleagues kind of seized on. And the university seized on and exploited, you know. I do think that there's a kind of hidden hand behind all this, but I think she, you know, what is that expression, target of opportunity? I think they used this young woman, you know, to jump all over me.
And in Ireland, we used to call that a useful idiot.
Yeah. Well, I think my colleagues may deserve that description as well.
Right. I think we're seeing a lot more of that in the world today, where people have gone and taken a side and they can't let go of it. They can't even move an inch. And then everything triggers them. You know, that's the latest thing in the lexicon, is people being triggered.
Right.
And I think a lot of that has to do with the way we've interacted with social media. We see it a lot here at the radio station, and I think we're seeing that a lot in the world, is that social media has manipulated. One of the discussions we've had here, it's slightly off topic, but it's going to get to the point. People do not call radio stations anymore. They don't send emails. But they interact with us on social media in volumes that are almost hard to deal with.
Right.
And so we're beginning to understand that our interaction with the community, other than what we send out, what we get back in again, we have to go to social media to get that.
That's very interesting.
And what do we find on social media? We find extremes in opinions about things. And as a community radio station, we've got it all here. Every possible slight of politics and belief, we air it here. So we get a lot of that, where no matter what you say, somebody's going to get triggered by it. But we're going to find it on social media. We're not going to find it directly. And those people, as we understand who they are in the community, they're the ones that are the most vocal and causing the most disharmony in the community.
And, Mark, you know, the other thing that I wanted to chime in on is that Twitter obviously allowed this student to carry on this rant, which goes right along with the alleged leftist propaganda machine that Twitter has sought to serve ever since all these frontline doctors have started coming out and saying the science doesn't fit your narrative.
Right. That's right. Well, it's something we actually talk about in class, is the way that the so-called social media platforms have served as, you know, conduits for basically state narratives. I mean, the official narratives that the government, you know, the Democratic Party, certainly, all the media, the medical profession, you know, they're all pushing it as hard as they can. And social media, as you've noted, is the medium of choice for most people. So a lot of the hostile emails, or I'm sorry, the hostile tweets that come out are not necessarily written by human beings. I mean, there are ways to create bots that will use certain well-worn formulas to you know, attack people who question the official narrative. It is a very, very effective propaganda medium, and the people who jumped Twitter and immediately vent their feelings, which are often based on misinformation, they then become mediums of propaganda as individuals. You know, it kind of flows through you. The problem with those platforms and with the internet in general is that while it does give us a kind of unprecedented access to all kinds of information, its immediacy also brings out the worst in us, you know, because you will, as you say, you're not getting emails, you're not getting calls, you're getting an immediate, brief, hysterical response that people fire off in their passion without thinking about anything. So it's kind of a double-edged sword, you know.
And I think once they've done that, once they've fired it off, they feel justified so that they have to cement that position even more.
Yeah.
Because now they've put it out for thousands of people. It's not just right into the station manager. You know, there's thousands of people that have now seen that post, and they have to defend it, and they have to cement their position on it. So it makes it even harder to negotiate, to discuss, to find common ground, all the rest of that, because you can't give up your position. You can't say that you're wrong.
That's so true, and it's especially true of professionals, okay?
Oh, without a doubt.
they're actually the worst. I mean, journalists, by and large, certainly academics and doctors, and I suppose a lot of lawyers, you know, people who've been through professional training become very arrogant, you know, especially when they have PhDs. And that notion that, well, this can't be true because I would know about it, right?
Exactly right.
Right. It's really stunning. And I continue to be, you know, just gobsmacked by the ignorance that they show to this very day, you know, exchanging bits of alarmist news about the new variant, you know, and the need for something, you know, more booster shots. And the vaccine passport will only solve the problem partly. These are people who consider themselves progressive, and they are abject authoritarians who get angry if you suggest that, you know, maybe what they think they know is false because all they read is the New York Times and the Atlantic, and they listen to NPR, you know?
Yeah.
They hear the same thing over and over again. So if you tell them about the frontline doctors, they just get angry. You know, who are you to tell me that I don't know everything? And these are people teaching our students. You know, it's really bad.
And then they cross-pollinate. You get somebody that's an attorney who suddenly becomes an expert on medicine and specialties in medicine like virology, you know. Mm-hmm. I had a friend who is an excellent orthopedic surgeon. I would not let him do a root canal on me. But that's what you see. You see these experts in their field, and they might be extremely knowledgeable in their field, move into another field with the same sense of
right.
being an expert. And that's, I think, the problem. I know you said you're not an oracle, but where do you see us going with this? As you're teaching these classes with young, malleable minds, is all I can describe them as. Where are we going with this? Is it going to get worse? Is it going to get better? Are we going to figure it out? What?
I'm going to give you my own view, okay?
Okay.
Yeah, that'll
work.
Be our start.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I actually think that we're at a moment of unprecedented crisis. I believe, on the basis of my, you know, conversations with and readings of a lot of these dissident figures, I think there is no benign explanation for what's going on now with this enormous experimental so-called vaccination program, which has been rolled out all over the world, while doctors who object, you know, scientists who object, you mentioned a few already, they're all vilified, they're slandered, they're blacked out, okay? I will listen to a former vice president at Pfizer and this chief scientist at that company, Mike Yeadon. I will listen to him when he says that we can't explain the policies that they've imposed without drawing the conclusion that this is some kind of mass depopulation effort. Now, I've studied eugenics, that whole junk science that dates from the early 20th century, that the Rockefellers and others have been pushing, that Bill Gates believes in, and, you know, we need more people to understand that buried history of the eugenics movement, which never went away. It's about getting the fit to reproduce and finding ways to prevent the unfit from reproducing. It actually puts Hitler in the shade, okay? Hitler was a student of that movement too, by the way. So my view is that the people who get it and the people whose minds are still open are the ones to talk to. I have wasted far too much breath, many, many man hours of trying to persuade closed minds among academics and journalists trying to persuade them that they don't get it, you know, that they're not looking at all the evidence. They're only looking at the so-called evidence presented in the propaganda narrative. It is a waste of time and effort. I think it's crucial that we help young people, you know, grasp all aspects of these issues. They'll come to the conclusion that masking, the claim that there's such a thing as asymptomatic spread, that there's such a thing as super spreaders, the redefinition of herd immunity, the redefinition of what a pandemic is, the wild exaggeration of the numbers of those supposedly killed by COVID, and the simultaneous blackout on the shocking numbers of people who've been killed by these so-called vaccines, and the millions more who've been gravely injured. I mean, we can find out about this on social media. And I think the time has come for people to say no. You know, that this is, I'm not afraid to say that this is an evil project. It is not intended to save lives. It's intended to prevent them and to end them, you know? And that's something we have to stand against and do it as intelligently and learnedly and rationally as possible. And that's very hard when you're surrounded by people who've been put to sleep and become furious when you try to wake them up.
It's going to be a really rough road. What you just described is you know, there's a very small chance of that working, at least initially.
Right.
I think maybe over time, as more and more information comes out and more doctors who have opposed this are proven correct, I think maybe then we'll get it. But it might be too late at that point.
Well, I'm afraid, I mean, I hate to say this. It breaks my heart because I know so many people who've been jabbed, but I think it's gonna take a tremendous amount of emotional and psychological strength to see a lot of people in big trouble when the weather turns cold and they encounter other respiratory viruses. I dread that happening, but I think it will. And I agree with you. I think that the project that's being inflicted on the whole world now is so grandiose, it's so insane, and it's so directly hostile to nature and really to God, I have to say, that it can't work. It reminds me of the Tower of Babel. But it has succeeded far too much already, and it's just necessary to speak out against it, as you guys do and I have done. I hear from a lot of people I never would have met as a professor in New York City, just terrific people all over the country and the world. So I am actually confident that outside the kind of bubble I'm in, that there's a majority who are rational and willing to hear the truth and who know how to take care of themselves and their children, you know? So that heartens me, and my students hearten me, because most of them are much more open-minded than this young woman, and that's why I love teaching. It gives me hope, you know.
Well, Mark, you know, we've also had previous discussions on this program about cognitive dissonance.
Right.
And how it's very, very difficult, and I'm sure this is part of your propaganda narrative, that people sometimes have a hard time understanding in your face, well, why would my government want to kill me? Why would they do such a thing?
That's exactly right. There's a great quote from Marshall McLuhan who said that, you know, the little lies can be exposed, but the big lies are protected by public incredulity, right? People cannot believe that their government, their health officials, their governors would do something so destructive. It's kind of like, you know, an abused child not wanting to face the truth about their own parents, you know? People, Americans have lost their longtime healthy suspicion of authority. And that's, I think, directly due to the CIA's propaganda drive in 1967 to get the phrase conspiracy theory into journalistic discourse. This memo that they sent out to all their station chiefs worldwide is memo 1035-960, people can find it online. And what that memo instructed the station chiefs to do was to help discredit the work of writers who were questioning the Warren Report, you know, about Kennedy's assassination in Dallas. These books like Rush to Judgment by Mark Lane and others were becoming bestsellers because they raised really intelligent and necessary questions about that narrative. So the CIA, you know, covertly, you know, swung into action, instructing their station chiefs to get their media assets, wherever they were stationed, to discredit these conspiracy theorists. The memo actually calls them that. The phrase conspiracy theorist had actually never been used before 1967, while the phrase conspiracy theory was used only now and then. That's the moment when you find the phrase occurring more and more and more, and, you know, its use increased after the murders of Reverend King and Bobby Kennedy. They shot up exponentially after 9/11, and now they're being used in the most alarming way as a kind of synonym for what they call domestic terrorism. You know, if you argue that the last election was stolen, as I do, if you you raise questions about that so-called attempted coup on January 6th, because there's a lot of questions to be raised about it, you're somehow a domestic terrorist, and you're on the far right, right? So the use of this phrase has turned into a really effective cudgel to shut down inconvenient questions, and it is one of the things my colleagues accused me of, just as they accused me of hate speech. You know, that's cancel culture. And they accused me of putting the community at risk by having my students study the science behind masking. So that's like the censorship trifecta, you know?
Yeah, it certainly is.
Right? So that's something that makes my case really important, is it kind of sums up all the ways in which dissent is discredited and shut down.
Well, I see a glimmer in hope in this discussion. Is for a long time we were concerned that public schools stopped teaching critical thinking. And they got into, you know, worker bee stuff. The bell rings, you do this. The bell rings, you do that. And
right.
You believe everything that's in the textbook. A lot of us homeschooled our kids because of that.
Right.
But that did create a large body of people out there, probably the majority of people out there, that are perfectly willing to listen to anything that they're told. The hope that I see is you actually have students in your class and a class about propaganda.
Right.
And I think that's a very hopeful sign that you are creating the seeds of the new generation that's going to question authority like we did back in the 60s when we were young bucks. So.
Yeah. No, amen to that. I mean, I still identify as being on the left in the 60s sense. You know, that was about being against the war,
yes,
against corporate power, you know, certainly against censorship. Now the left is completely unrecognizable to me. They are the most authoritarian, the most censorious, the most racist, actually. I you know, they're shocking to me. So I'm like many others, and I think that includes you. I'm like politically stranded or marooned. I would much rather talk to people on the right and to libertarians than most people who identify as liberal or progressive, you know? And that's, I think they've been weaponized to help push through the agenda that's really behind all this. You know, it's the Great Reset. I mean, there are different names for it.
Well,
they want absolute control of all society and the entire economy, you know, with us, as you say, you know, reduced to being those of us who survived the culling are supposed to be good worker bees to service, you know, the elite's needs. It really is a dystopian vision that they're pushing for, you know. So I have always had most of my students really kind of get it, and that continues to be a source of hope for me too.
I'm amazed, Mark, that you teach at NYU, and what we just heard during this show smacks with everything that we have been saying for the last year and a half, ever since this nonsense started.
Well, I only wish I had been you know, I've been informed that you guys were doing this because I would be a faithful listener, you know, because this is the kind of thing that we have to get out there, despite the censorship, which is really shocking, you know, the extent to which Facebook, Twitter, and Google, and Amazon, you know, and Instagram are all on board, you know, with this propaganda program. You know, the obverse of propaganda always is censorship, right? Propaganda doesn't want an argument, right? So it's different from rhetoric, which is sort of the art of persuasion. You know, and you, a lawyer, understand this. You make a case to the jury, you know? Your adversary makes a different case to the jury, and they decide. Okay, that's what happened, like in ancient Greece and Rome, to some extent, is that different speakers tried to persuade the polis, the people, of the truth of their particular view, and then the people made a decision. Right? That's not what propaganda does. Propaganda wants to shut down all disagreement. It wants people not even knowing there's a disagreement. Right? They want people, you know, incapable of conceiving another side of the story. And to that end, they want to fill your mind, you know, with their narrative, and they want to fill all the available space with their narrative, right? So when, for example, you know, Big Pharma spends a lot of money on advertising, you know, on a radio station or a TV station or a magazine or a newspaper or a website, they expect that everything that appears in that medium will complement their message, will serve their interests. And if there is an article, you know, of some kind or a segment that you know, exposes some of the awful truth about what Big Pharma is doing, they'll pull those dollars, right? So it's come to kind of a crisis point now, as the media is almost wholly controlled by five multinational corporations that each own shares the other. You know, it's a media cartel. So that kind of control filters all the way down to ground level, and everybody follows the same script. And I have to say, most of the so-called left press is also on board. This has blown my mind, because I used to write for the left press. Now they're all pushing vaccines. They're all engaged in COVID alarmism. They're completely woke, you know. They don't object to the racism of the woke left or any of that stuff. They don't defend women's rights against trans activism. I mean, that's the left media, right? And they're all funded by the Rockefeller Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Open Society Institute. I mean, those are often pass-throughs for CIA funding.
And then so, you got BlackRock and Vanguard and everybody else that, you know, we've been reporting have a big interest in Big Pharma and God knows how many other multinational corporations. But our clock is winding down here, Mark, and we really appreciate your insight. And we'd love to have you back on the show in the future. And I'd like to also, we are going to, and I promise, as a libertarian, I will be following your case.
I appreciate that very much.
And we appreciate you, sir, and your time you took to call us up here and be with us on City Spotlight. And thank you so much for being on the show.
Okay. I look forward to the next time. Thanks.
You bet. Take care.
Bye-bye.
All right. There you go, ladies and gentlemen. Mark Crispin Miller. And I hope that was an eye-opener.
It was for me. It was for me, and I'm not that far away from what he teaches, you know, having, again, like he said, can you imagine a courtroom where the prosecution got to do a closing argument and the defense didn't? How do you think that those cases would turn out? And that's what's going on with propaganda and with what's pulling us in specific directions. And like we say, boys and girls, you need to some critical thinking, some critical research, and then make a personal decision, not the decision that your neighbors or your buddies are making. I mean, you may end up in the same place, but at least you made the decision, and it wasn't some group that made the decision.
So do we have time to get in a couple of tidbits here? Let's play some music here. Yeah. No, not that one.
Not that one.
That one. Isn't it true?
Isn't it true?
Yeah, we got a couple of ABA journals to get in here before. Isn't it true? Well, of course it is, boys and girls. Hey, you remember that story I read about the judge that the Black Lives Matter people accused of trying to run him over with his car.
Right.
Well, guess what? Citing lack of evidence, prosecutor dropped summons against appeals judge accused of nearly hitting protester. A specially appointed prosecutor will not be pursuing a case against a North Carolina appeals judge who's accused of nearly hitting a BLM protester with his SUV. He dismissed a criminal court summons seeking the appearance of Judge John M. Tyson of the North Carolina Court of Appeals, according to the Fayetteville Observer. The law media jumped all over it. Prosecutor cited insufficient evidence.
Oh, well.
So he's not going to get charged.
And remember, too, that was a specially appointed prosecutor. That wasn't somebody that is in the prosecutor's department that this judge may deal with.
Exactly.
There was somebody they pulled in from the outside that took a look at it and said, whoa, you don't have anything here.
Got to love that. But you're going to love this one even more.
Okay.
Several minutes into Ninth Circuit online hearing, lawyer realizes he's arguing the wrong case. I knew you would love this one.
Oh, geez. No, so, no, and I'm laughing because I have actually seen that over the years.
You have not.
I saw it once where, you know, he finally brought up the name of his client, and the judge looked down at the charge sheet, and I looked down at it, and I said, and the judge said, are you sure this is the case we're arguing today? I mean, they were similar problems, but it was just a different name, and so it was a different case. And, you know, of course, everybody laughs, and, you know, but that could have been really nasty if he had never said his client's name.
Oh,
yeah. If he just kept saying my client, it would have gone through. What a mess that would have been.
So. Well, according to Social Security claimant's lawyer, Chad Hatfield, he didn't realize his goof until several minutes into an argument last Monday before the Ninth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals in San Francisco. He's a lawyer from Washington. He was talking about fibromyalgia symptoms when judges said they were looking at a case concerning diabetes, manic depressive disorder, and social phobia. Boy, that's right. The opposite end of things. Check to make sure you've got the right case in front of you, said one of the judges. At that time, about 5 minutes and 10 seconds into the video, Hatfield realized he was arguing the wrong case. Original Jurisdiction blogger and Above the Law founder David Ladd has a story. They were all over this thing, man. He explained he was scheduled to argue two cases this month. His scheduler had put down the fibromyalgia case to be argued that day and the other case for next week. I am flip-flopped, he said. Many judges would have berated Hatfield, according to Original Jurisdiction, bench-slapping him to high heaven, but this panel handled the situation graciously. He was given a 10-minute break to prepare for the other case. He came back and delivered a solid argument, and he might prevail, according to the blog. He did not, of course, reply to the ABA Journal, but Original Jurisdiction also chronicled a mistake in a different case involving different lawyers, originally pointed out on how appealing. Two Missouri lawyers from Montgomery and Newcomb filed notices that they were appealing two separate but identical cases. The notices said that appeals from the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Missouri to the U.S. District Court of Appeals for the Southern District of Missouri. All right? So, District Court and Court of Appeals. The Original Jurisdiction pointed out two errors. First, there is no Southern District of Missouri. There are only federal courts for the Eastern and Western Districts of Missouri. Second, the appeals court name should be the Eighth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals, which is based in St. Louis. The Eighth Circuit tossed the appeals based on lack of jurisdiction. These notices of appeal are entirely deficient, according to the Eighth Circuit. They appeal an order entered on a day when no order issued from a district court that doesn't exist to a court of appeals that does not exist.
Oh,
so,
wow.
You know,
and wait a minute. That guy got paid to do that.
I know. And on a scale of 1 to 10.
Yeah,
well, I mean,
that 10 for entertainment value on both of that. He got paid to not even get the heading right.
You got to love it. Oh,
time for one more.
All right, you're going to love this. We'll stay in trials and litigation because it gets really good. Pro se defendants' grandiose remarks not disqualifying, Fourth Circuit says. Some trial lawyers are outright narcissists. A defendant who made grandiose statements while defending himself was of the same ilk of many great trial lawyers who are somewhat full of themselves, a federal appeals court concluded in upholding his conviction. The Fourth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals at Richmond, Virginia, ruled that a trial judge did not abuse his discretion when he allowed Joseph Ziegler to represent himself on a charge of impersonating a federal officer. Ziegler was prosecuted for falsely claiming he was an assistant U.S. attorney after he crashed his car and trying to avoid an arrest on charges of drunk driving and driving without a license, insurance, or vehicle registration. Judge Julius Richardson, who's an appointee of former President Donald Trump and a former federal prosecutor, wrote the unanimous panel opinion rejecting Ziegler's arguments on appeal. Ziegler contends his grandiose statements about his legal acumen, his combative approach to witnesses, his bizarre questions and theories, and his arguments with the court should have raised red flags. We disagree, the appeals court said. Many great trial lawyers are combative and a bit full of themselves, if not outright narcissists. Ziegler told a judge he should be allowed to represent himself because he'd studied law and had a degree in criminal justice. Ziegler also said he represented himself once before getting the conviction reversed because the prosecution got caught falsifying transcripts. Ziegler said he has published cases in which I've represented myself. I'm very familiar with all 27 amendments of the U.S. Constitution, various SCOTUS cases, and I've successfully assisted prisoners inside of jails and prisons across America. He also claimed familiarity with writs of habeas corpus, quorum nobis, and the like. In reality, Ziegler's other pro se conviction was reversed because a judge failed to follow proper statutory procedures in allowing the self-representation. After Ziegler filed pretrial motions in the impersonation case, the judge counseled Ziegler to allow a public defender to represent him. It's obvious to me you're not a sophisticated person as far as your knowledge of the law, a trial judge told Ziegler. The defendant stood his ground, however, and was allowed to represent himself. At trial, Ziegler cross-examined government witnesses extensively, asking several strange questions while arguing with witnesses and the judge. But he also gave an opening and closing arguments, made good points on cross, had objections sustained, and introduced evidence, including three witnesses, according to the opinion. After his conviction, Ziegler argued he needed a psychological evaluation.
Yes.
A judge refused to grant a new trial and sentenced Ziegler to time served. Ziegler appealed, arguing in part that he should not have been allowed to represent himself. While not always accurate, Ziegler's statements reflected his ability to consider legal concepts and strategy, even if those concepts and strategies were ill-advised, the Fourth Circuit wrote. Ziegler's trial performance only confirmed his competency, Richardson wrote. In fact, Ziegler did quite well for someone proceeding pro se. His apparent ability to consider strategic choices, develop a sense strategy, and operate in the courtroom is all evidence of competence to both stand trial and waive the right to counsel, Richardson said. So there you have.
Yeah, he should apply for law school. We could use another one.
Oh, you got to love that. Hey, what can I say? This has been a very, very interesting show.
Loved having him on. He was great.
Yeah, we'll have to have Mark Crispin Miller back on again. We thank him so much for being here with us on City Spotlight Special Edition. Dave Krieger and RJ Malloy wishing you the best this week. Remember the saying, sine me too, go without fear and use your head. Until next time, we bid you adieu.